From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. A new Iowa State University study has found high-heel shoes can lead to knee degeneration and osteoarthritis. This hour, we speak with one of the researchers who conducted the study, along with a participant. Then we look at media portrayals of beauty and other practices that may be harmful, including research on risk-taking behavior in women with regards to tanning beds. What's the price you pay for beauty? Are there things you do even though they're a pain and you know they could be harmful? Have you changed your attitude about beauty and what you're willing to do to achieve our society's ideal of beauty? Tell us your story. Our discussion starts after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You know the expression, beauty is pain. Well, recent research at Iowa State University seems to confirm it's not only pain, but harm in regards to wearing stilettos, wedges, pumps, kitten heels. There's reason for concern about what those heels may be doing to the wearer's knees and joints over time. A new study finds wearing high-heeled shoes can lead to knee degeneration and osteoarthritis. Joining us now to discuss the study is Danielle Barkema. Danielle is an Iowa State University master's student in kinesiology. She recently completed her thesis studying the effects of high-heeled walking on forces acting on lower extremity joints. Kinesiology professor and department head Phil Martin assisted her in the study, which will be presented at the annual meeting of the American Society of Biomechanics later this month. Danielle, welcome to our program.
Yes, thank you.
Also joining us, a participant in the study, Laura Dillavoux. Good afternoon to you from our studios in Ames.
Good afternoon.
Danielle, let's talk about your study. How did you come to study the potential health risks of high heels?
Well, it was actually inspired by my twin sister. She got a job in Chicago after graduating at Iowa State, and she was working retail at a fairly well-known department store in Chicago, and she kind of noticed, well, she was wearing high heels pretty much all day, every day, and she noticed a lot of her coworkers were as well, and specifically the older women that she was working with, she noticed a lot of them seemed to have problems of some sort or complaining of pain, you know, various hip pain, knee pain, things like that, and had had issues such as a hip replacement as well. And these women had been wearing high heels pretty much all day, every day for a period of years. So she mentioned it to me, and, you know, I thought it was interesting. I wear high heels myself, not as much as I used to, but so I just thought it'd be a good project to study and certainly worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. And you are already into the study of movement, kinesiology, human movement, kinesiology at this time, or did this persuade you to get into that area?
I was already in, and I had done my undergrad in kinesiology, but I hadn't actually decided if I was going to go into biomechanics, I decided kind of to look at the forces on your joints during high-heeled walking.
Okay, so tell us more about the findings in detail. What exactly does the study indicate? Because I know this has received a lot of press, hasn't it?
Yeah, more than I expected. So what we were kind of doing, the purpose, like we were talking about, was to look at the changes that occur in high-heeled walking and see if these changes specifically affecting the lower extremity joints, so the hip, knee, and ankle, to see if this leads to any adverse loading at these joints. And our focus was mainly on the knee joint, as you sort of recall from the title of most of these articles and whatnot. But we were focusing on this loading that takes place on the knee during normal walking. So you have a medial compartment and a lateral compartment of the knee. And during normal walking, you get this small sort of compression on the inner part or the medial part of the knee. And basically, it's been shown that this greater medial loading or this greater compression on the inner part of the knee has been linked to the development of knee osteoarthritis over time. There had been some previous high-heeled walking studies that had shown that there is sort of an increase in this medial loading with going from a barefoot to like a mid-heel, we kind of wanted to look more systematically and see if this relationship continued to increase with an increase in heel height.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we used the flat shoe and then a mid-heel of about 2 inches and a high heel of 3.5 inches.
And so can you say then that the heel height, the higher the heel, the higher the risk factor?
Yeah, our results showed that there was a systematic increase in this medial compartment compression, this greater inner loading I'm talking about, as heel height went up. So it systematically did increase, which is basically saying, yeah, by wearing high heels, you are putting yourself at greater risk for developing knee osteoarthritis later in life, and specifically, the higher the heel, the greater the risk.
Let's turn to Laura Dillavu, a study participant. Why did you get involved in this study, Laura?
She sent it to me originally as an announcement to get participants, and when I saw it, I knew that I wore high heels quite often.
The high heels or the lower ones?
The high heels.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it'd be very interesting to be a part of it and just learn more about what good-looking fashion was actually doing to my joints.
So as part of the study, what did you actually have to do?
I came in two different times, and as Danielle mentioned, there was a flat shoe, a 2-inch heel, and a 3.5-inch heel. And so for each of those, I did walking trials where in the biomechanics lab, I walked across the surface and had to hit a force plate. And at that point, Danielle captured data that measured what my joints were doing and the loading effects, and my ankle, my knee, my hip, and then also how the force of each step traveled up my body. So there were sensors on my ankles, my knees, my hips, and then also one up on my head, which measured the force of the shock.
Laura, how many years would you say you've been wearing high heels?
I would say at least 8 to 10 years.
Have you sensed any ill effects?
I have not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very fortunate to be healthy and young, and I stay quite active.
Mm-hmm. So has this study and the results, of course, is that going to change your high heel behavior?
I don't think so. I'm 5'1", so being a little bit taller is important to me, and heels do that. And so,
Important enough to risk the health risks that seem to be indicated by this study, huh?
For right now, I'm okay with it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So Danielle, this is interesting. So how many participants did you have, like Laura, that you were looking at?
I had 15 women participate in this study.
Mm-hmm. So that you ran them through this routine, this type of study. So interesting. I want to ask you, Danielle, what message do you think these findings should send women?
And I think kind of it's important to note that a lot of women, you know, do know that these high heels are going to or could cause problems, you know, later in life, as well as initial discomfort. And I'm not expecting, you know, people to read these results and completely change their footwear decisions and never wear high heels because they are fun to wear. I just kind of hope that, you know, maybe this provides a little bit more concrete evidence to say that perhaps you should maybe try to limit it a little bit at least.
Mm-hmm.
I tell my friends to try to limit their wearing as much as possible, not to completely not wear them. But, obviously, if you can avoid wearing them all day, every day, that would be probably ideal.
Mm-hmm. You said it's fun to wear high heels. Give me a better sense of what the fun is about. I'm going to reveal for the first time on the airwaves for sure that at the age of 10, I did try on high heels at my friend's house. They were my friend's sisters. And promptly, we decided it wasn't a challenge enough to walk across the floor, but we tried to walk down to the basement and fell. So I'm guessing that the risk of just simply wearing high heels and perhaps tripping is also a risk factor here, or perhaps I just should have practiced longer.
there's certainly more risks for slips, trips, and falls.
And that's been proven in studies, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm, and that's been shown. And there's been shown higher, you know, incidence of ankle sprains in women that wear high heels. And you do become sort of accustomed to it as you wear it over time and get better at it. But what I was saying, like, it's fun. I mean, there's a lot of fun shoes out there that are, you know, just fun to include in your wardrobe and kind of, as well as the fact that most high heels do sort of make the women's body more aesthetically pleasing. You know, your legs look a little bit longer.
We accent the calves, right? It changes
mm-hmm.
the calf muscle quite a bit.
Yes, that too. Mm-hmm.
And Laura finds very valuable that we bring that height of 5'1" up a little bit to be more of the height of men, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Now, the feeling of wearing high heels, it places a lot more of the pressure on the ball of your feet. Is that what it is?
Yeah, mostly due to the design of the shoe. It's kind of forcing some more pressure forward, so in that medial forefoot area. So you'll feel less in your heel, but you'll kind of be in that sort of leaned forward position, which is where you feel it, you know, that medial forefoot.
Is there anything about the design of high heel shoes besides simply the heel that can make them healthier? Anything to stabilize or in the design of the sole? I don't know, but are there differences between high heel shoes in terms of their health that you could measure or imagine here that not necessarily just with the heel height?
Yeah, and I mean, there's various things that designers have done to try to make them more comfortable, whether that be adding more cushion to different parts of the shoe, there's a lot of things you can do. And I think that's what, you know, designers would like to, their main goal is comfort. Obviously, a high-heeled shoe can only be so comfortable. But I will say that there probably are things being done to help make it better comfort-wise and for the body.
Uh-huh. What has been the reaction, Danielle, from the fashion industry? Have you had any feedback there?
I really haven't. And I'm sure they probably get, you know, things. They probably get press all the time saying that, you know, high-heeled shoes are bad, and they probably just don't really react to it all that much. I've really not heard anything. It's mainly just been news services that has kind of picked this story up.
Yeah, so it has received a lot of attention among media. So how many interviews have you done about this, would you say?
Oh, gosh. Probably about 10 now or so, 10 to 12. I keep getting calls pretty much every day. So
from just the United States or outside the United States as well?
For the most part, the United States. I did do a Toronto newspaper as well as an Australian radio station. I think those are the only that are actually international. But
mm-hmm. Okay. And the reaction in the field of kinesiology to your study?
Well, I really haven't, you know, been able to kind of gather that information quite yet, because like I was saying, I just finished this study. I'm in the process of submitting it to a peer-reviewed journal, so I'll get some more feedback there.
Okay.
And then as you were saying, I'm going to that conference in about a week and a half.
At Brown University. We have to take a short break. We'll be back with Danielle Barkema. Danielle, stay by. Stay with us. Laura Dillavu, thank you very much for sharing your experiences with us as a participant in this study.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll talk more about the price of beauty in terms of pain, and what drives beauty, why we feel we can sacrifice a little bit of our health and comfort for it. When we come back, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefertang, looking at the price of beauty in terms of health today, things that we do to look beautiful that may not be good for us. Danielle Barkema with us, an Iowa State University kinesiology master's student, recently came out with a study that shows that the effects of high-heeled walking on forces acting on the lower extremity joints and can lead to knee problems. We want to reach out to you. Will this study make you stop wearing high heels? Why or why not? What other things can you think of in terms of the price you pay for beauty that may be not very comfortable or not very healthy? Are there things you do even though you know they could be harmful? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Joining our discussion now, Mary Lynn Damhorst in Ames at the Iowa Public Radio Studios in Ames, an Iowa State University professor in the Department of Apparel, Educational Studies, and Hospitality Management. Professor Damhorst, welcome to our program.
Good afternoon.
What's your reaction to this study? Are you surprised about the high-heeled shoes being potentially damaging in the long term?
No, I'm not surprised at all. At my age, we won't disclose what that is, but I think it's not surprising to me that is happening. It is something that I'm guessing a lot of people will, when they're younger and they're not feeling these painful effects right away, it's going to be difficult for them to avoid continuing on wearing those for multiple reasons.
You not only look at shoes, but a lot of other areas of that have to do with fashion and apparel. Where does this latest research about high heels fit into the bigger fashion picture when you see how it overlaps with health and the degree to which we're ready to endure pain and discomfort and perhaps long-term health implications for the sake of beauty?
Well, it fits in with a variety of streams of research on why people do tanning, even though we know that that can increase the risks of cancer, skin cancer, dieting, excessive dieting, and becoming eating disordered are certainly motives related to appearance that can cause problems in some individuals. And certainly there has been historic research on foot binding in China, traditional Chinese society before the or up until the beginning of the 20th century, and other societies that do things to the body that are painful but are considered beautiful and attractive. So when you have this motive to be attractive and your society defines something as attractive, it's very difficult to go against that tradition, that way of doing things.
Can you tell us anything about how and why women have come to wear high heels?
You know, I don't know the history on that. I believe it was back in the 1700s or 1600s. I think you can find women wearing high heels at those times. Mm-hmm. I'm not a costume historian, so I don't know the full reason for that.
Perhaps, Danielle, do you know any of that?
No, I think you're right. I've heard 1600s, 1700s, but again, I don't know the full history on why that came to be the shoe it is today. But
You mentioned foot binding. I mean, of course, with high heels, it's not foot binding, but it is something that inhibits running. You cannot sprint. You cannot get away. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I guess I'm picturing high heels on cave women, which is probably not what we should be doing. Let's talk a little bit. Let's introduce Alicia Cast is with us, an Iowa State University faculty member, associate professor of sociology. Good afternoon to you, Professor Cast.
Hello.
What influences in our society make us want to look good? Where does the pressure come from, within or without?
Well, I think it comes from both places. I mean, certainly our society provides us with cultural images within the media, peers, friends, families, everyone provides us with certain standards or expectations or beliefs about what constitutes an attractive body. And then because of all of the social goods that go along with being attractive in our society, we then try to achieve those standards of beauty, of attractiveness, so that we ourselves can accumulate those social goods that oftentimes are just as simple as that spring in your step, that you know, feeling good about yourself and feeling pretty. I was thinking about that song on the way over to the radio station today. You know, I feel pretty, and the importance of that to kind of our overall self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering when especially women here feel pretty or not pretty. You know, some women to whatever degree, some women refuse to wear high heels. Some love to wear high heels. We'll be talking about makeup in the later in the hour. Some wear no makeup, some wear a little, some wear a lot. So what does that say about us, the degree to which we have high heels and make these accommodations for the sake of what we see as beauty, Alicia?
Well, I don't know that it says much about anybody as an individual necessarily. I think all of us succumb to social pressures in one way or another to be particular kinds of people, to wear particular kinds of clothing, including our shoe wear, wearing particular kinds of hairstyles, all sorts of material items that we use to present a particular self to the world. So all of us, to some degree, succumb to social pressures because we just kind of have to in order to get along, to be socially accepted. And in some circles, there may be more or less pressure To wear particular kinds of clothing. I was reading some research this morning that suggests that people are kind of more traditional in their attitudes towards male and female roles in society are much more likely to adopt these more idealized conceptions of femininity and beauty and attractiveness and things like that. So there's a wide variability, of course, across individuals, but all of us, I think, feel pressure to wear particular styles of clothing because we know we'll be judged on that basis.
Professor Damhorst, you are active, a faculty member in the Department of Apparel, Educational Studies, and Hospitality Management. In regards to apparel, can you say whether our ideals of beauty our fashion has become more or less healthy over recent decades? I mean, women don't wear corsets anymore. That's very healthy, right?
Yes, that's a good thing, not to wear those regularly, because that does have – there's even been research done in my own department by a grad student a number of years ago, and they did find it had had bad effects, difficult – or effects on the body of, in terms of reducing breathing and other kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And corsets can – basically take over the duty that the skeletal, that the muscles do in the back, and can cause a lot of problems. But I don't know that we've become healthier. We're wearing, we're wearing high heels now, are in fashion that are higher than they've ever been. I mean, even as a young person back in the 70s and 80s, I wore high heels, but I don't. It wasn't common to be wearing, you know, 5 inches, 4 inch heels. Mm-hmm. So that we're getting healthier, I think we just, you know, trade certain things off in terms of what we do. So yes, we're not wearing corsets now, but people are dieting excessively, wearing high heels, tanning, and those were things that were not necessarily done back when women were wearing corsets.
So. We have a couple minutes before we have to take a short break, but I want to turn to the other half of the equation, of course, here. Men play an interesting part here. What about men? How is male beauty different in terms of its potential for discomfort or health? Are men get off easy here? Do they get to be casual and in footwear and apparel, Professor Damhorst?
Well, we have different roles in society traditionally for men and women. And for men, traditionally, they had a role of being physically active and physically adept. And so their clothing tends to facilitate that kind of activity. So even for formal wear, except for those ties that a lot of men feel are horrifyingly choking, they wear clothing or have come to wear clothing in the 20th and 21st century that allows them to, at any moment's notice, be fairly physically active. So more comfortable shoes, shoes that are allowing them to be physically active, as well as other aspects of their clothing. So I think it's a long-term traditional role of men that when we see men as attractive, they maybe have been lucky, I don't know, to have had
Their role is to be more mobile.
Yes.
And to get around as a...
And physically adept, whereas women have what we sometimes call a hedonic role, and that role has been around a long time in so-called Western society and is around in a lot of other cultures, too, for women to be aesthetically attractive in society as well as to be sexually attractive.
We have to take a short break. We'll be right back with Professor Mary Lynn Damhorst of the University, Iowa State University, also Alicia Cast on the faculty and professor of sociology at ISU. We'd like to get your input as well as we look at how healthy our society's relationship with beauty is. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a few minutes. Great to have you with us over the noon hour for The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Workers at the Ames Laboratory may have been exposed to several cancer-causing toxic substances. This was during the Cold War era and also before that time. And tomorrow we'll talk with the widow of one of the lab workers at the Ames Laboratory who is seeking compensation, also a doctor who regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic exposure. That's tomorrow on The Exchange over the noon hour. Today we're talking about beauty, things we do to look beautiful that may not be good for us. In the first half hour, we spoke with an ISU master's student in kinesiology, Danielle Barkham. I didn't get a chance to say thank you and goodbye to her. Thank you, Danielle. Her new study that looks at high-heeled shoes and how they can lead to knee degeneration and osteoarthritis. What are you willing to do? What price are you willing to pay for beauty in terms of discomfort or ill health? Tell us your story, perhaps your attitude towards beauty and what you're willing to do to achieve our society's ideal of beauty has changed over time. Tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames, Mary Lynn Damhorst, and professor in the Department of Apparel, Educational Studies, and Hospitality Management. Also, Alicia Cast, Associate Professor of Sociology at ISU. And another person joining our round of discussion here, Chrissy Moutsatsous, Assistant Professor of Women's Studies and Anthropology at ISU. And welcome to our program, Professor Moutsatsous.
Thank you.
You've done research on the cosmetics industry, which we want to start talking about, along with all these other things. You've looked at the reasons why women wear makeup and use other beauty products. Tell us, first of all, what is the function of makeup? What are we doing there that perhaps nature didn't do enough of?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think it's one that the attention should be drawn to history. The uses of makeup are also historical and depend on the era that we look at. If we think about the use of makeup today, it has a lot to do with identity. It has a lot to do with the presentation of the self. And also it has a lot to do with making the body look as feminine as possible. So makeup itself is kind of transformative in the way it which it can help any woman have a certain kind of identity as a feminine woman.
Mm-hmm. So more feminine, what facial features are accented and why?
Well, all of them are accented. There's not a part of the face that is not subjected to modification through makeup these days. There are so many products on the market. The eyes, of course, are always important because we believe here in the West that you can see the soul through the eyes, and it's the first thing that you would notice on an individual, whether it's a man or a woman. But the lips also have a lot of attention these days. Think about all the products that are there to make the lips bigger and plumper and more prominent. So, but again, there isn't a part of the face that is not targeted by the makeup industry.
I wonder if there's any connection with makeup and the way makeup is put on with the rest of the animal world. Are humans the only way, the only animals who enhance their faces this way? I'm just thinking about, you know, cats and raccoons and how faces can be made up to resemble animals as well.
Well, I do think that the makeup industry is very well tied into the fashion industry. And as fashion changes, so does makeup. It also plays a role in drawing attention. So I'm sure that the fashion industry and the makeup industry draw a lot of inspiration from nature. But it's really curious that animals, of course, have certain behaviors that they engage in to attract each other. But they, from what I know, they don't use products. The use of products is definitely something tied into capitalism and something tied into human culture.
Well, I guess I was, you know, of course they don't use products, but if they were animals, and this is not your area of specialty, but preening or something to make the face look different or accentuate some facial features in an animal is something that would be might be possible. But
sure, and preening is an important social behavior, and of course, it brings the animals together. It allows them to live with one another, especially if you look at primates. And we are primates also, so there are behaviors that perhaps have to do with our biology. But again, we need to look at history and look at the changes throughout history in the use of makeup. And especially in what has been deemed attractive in the past and what is deemed attractive today.
Mm-hmm. Are there any health implications for the use of cosmetics that people should be thinking about?
Absolutely. And this is, I think, the best kept secret that needs to become more common knowledge, is that cosmetic products are full of toxic ingredients that in many cases have carcinogenic effects in the laboratory. And one of the big problems with cosmetic products is that they're not regulated at all. Cosmetic companies can put any kind of ingredients they want in their products, and there is hardly any regulation. So cosmetic products are not as safe as we think, because many of the ingredients that they contain are toxic and pretty dangerous.
Are there cases where you can point to, concrete cases, where women have become sick or had skin problems due to the cosmetics they've chosen?
The problem is that the cosmetics are part of a larger environmental attack on the bodies of individuals these days. And, of course, there are women who have allergic reactions to certain products. But the danger of the cosmetic products is that over time there's a cumulative effect in the way in which these toxins affect us. So we don't get, most of us don't get sick by putting on a day cream, but we really don't know what the effects are of using several products throughout the day and throughout one's lifetime. One product that is particularly problematic are sunscreens. Sunscreens, we use them all of us have been trained to use them to protect our skin from the damaging effects of the sun and not get, for example, melanomas or skin cancers. But sunscreens themselves contain ingredients that may cause cancer over a long period of time. There are, of course, sunscreens on the market that don't contain these ingredients, such as parabens or phthalates, but they are not sold readily over any cosmetic counter. They're products that you have to know about and you can only buy at health food stores. They're more expensive, and so not everybody is going to be able to buy them.
I want to reach out to our listeners and ask, what do you think about our society's relationship with beauty and the products we buy to beautify ourselves, the procedures we go through, the price we pay in terms of discomfort or health? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. This email from Marty in Balltown. She asks, what about hair dye? Do we know if it has any harmful health effects? That's for you also, Professor Moutsatsous.
Absolutely. Hair dyes are harmful. Basically, if you can eat the product, it's not harmful. You would never eat hair dye. It's not something that you could ever digest. It would probably kill you. It is toxic. And unfortunately, women who work in the hairdressing field who are constantly in contact with dyes and other kind of chemicals for either straightening the hair or permanents and so on, they are very much subject to long-term illnesses because of the products that they come in contact with.
Professor Moutsatsous, a while ago you mentioned the way beauty has changed, ideals of beauty have changed from the past. I wanted to get all of your opinions on this, if you had comments, Professor Kast and Damhorst as well. Starting with you, Professor Moutsatsous, how have our ideals about beauty changed as we've progressed through the centuries into the 21st century?
In my opinion, the ideals of beauty have become more restricted. I think that at the moment we live and we're surrounded by a very narrow definition of beauty, one that is presented to us as always being heterosexual, always being white, looking like a Northern European blonde woman, very thin. It's a very narrow feminine aesthetic that we are confronted with. And we're bombarded with this image everywhere we turn, whether it's looking on programs on television or looking at advertisements or in general, we're surrounded by that. And I think it's a very particular point in time in history where only a certain kind of beauty is accepted as successful.
Mm-hmm. Is that the result of globalization, so that we have a homogenization of beauty worldwide, would you say?
I would agree with that. I think that's the tendency at the moment. Products are big cosmetic companies, the ones that set the tone for what is being sold, are multinationals. They sell in all countries around the world, and they promote pretty much one image. So, yes, it is very much a product of globalization. Not to say that there aren't voices of resistance and that there are other models of beauty out there, but they're not as dominant as the one I just described.
And Professor Cass, Professor Damhorst, jump in here and with your observations about how our ideals of beauty have changed and over the centuries and where we've arrived now. Professor Cass?
I guess the only thing I would add to that is that I agree, of course, but I also think that we're starting to see a more homogenous or specific view, restricted view of the masculine image as well. And so this is not just something that is for women, of course, that we're seeing an increasing pressure on men as well to achieve this idealized masculinity. And the current statistics show that about 20% of cosmetic procedures are actually men rather than women.
Interesting. Professor Cast, how much of the willingness to sacrifice our health has to do with a certain sort of denial or not believing that the actual health effects will come about? We talked about tanning. No one believes they are going to get skin cancer, for instance, until they do.
Well, I think in our contemporary culture, we're really sold the message that the body is something that we can shape, that we can buy stuff, we can do things in order to shape the body in the contemporary world and in our everyday life, but also probably long term as well. Not only do we perhaps not believe that it won't happen to us, but that there may be things that we'll be able to do about it when it does happen. If we spend too much time in the sun, we'll just get some Botox later,
right,
or something along those lines. And so we're really sold the message that the body is something to be shaped and manipulated.
Join our discussion about beauty and health, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email, also on Twitter at IPRTalk. Joining us from Cedar Falls, Matt, good afternoon to you, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Yes, your question or your observation?
Well, I want to follow up on the high heels discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an expat American that lives in Poland for the last over four years now. And it's my observation been that Polish women and perhaps European women in general wear per capita more high heels than Iowa women. I don't know where the study was conducted, but I think it would be curious to see what kind of impact it has on these women's health.
Did you live in an urban area in Poland?
I live in Warsaw, the capital, yeah.
Okay, so maybe this is an urban-rural issue, but what can we say about fashions and high heels? Our high heel expert is out of there, but perhaps Professor Damhorst, can you tell us anything about that, the cultural influence on fashion?
Some people would suggest that in many European countries there is more emphasis on a traditional notion of feminine beauty or women taking on that sexually attractive role. I think that it's so varied in terms of individuals that you're going to meet in Europe and whether they buy into those particular aesthetics. So it's hard to make deep generalizations. But I think, yes, when I travel in some countries, I see a lot of younger women in certain countries in Asia and in Europe seem to be very focused on wearing high heels a lot.
so younger women and so... There's an age demographic here. We can look at that.
Yes, and again, I think it's when you're young, being sexually attractive, finding a mate. These are essential components of your life. And if you're heterosexual and interested in attracting a man, I hear that men think that longer looking legs look attractive and sexy. And so heels lengthen the leg or visually lengthen the leg and seem to be give an attractive look to the leg for men. So, of course, younger women who are interested in attracting men might be more inclined to wear that.
And then as we grow older, when we get out of that sort of childbearing or looking for a mate stage in our life, we might just say, you know, I feel like having comfortable things on my feet to walk around in, and then that may tip the balance, huh?
Well, for some women, it becomes a physical necessity because of health reasons. For other women, you know, well into their 80s, they're still wearing heels if they can function in them. So, again, it really depends on the individual's attitudes towards comfort and looking sexually attractive. Hard to make sweeping generalizations because right. I see so much variety.
Professor Mutsatsu said, what about in the world of cosmetics? Are there certain cultures or ethnic groups that are more pro or against makeup than others?
Well, definitely in the United States and Northern Europe, it's required that women wear makeup. I mean, that's the way in which a modern feminine ideal is prescribed. I really don't know about other places so much, but again, we have to go back to the issue of globalization, is that all markets are interconnected. Even the most remote places now have access to market economies. And they do also have television. Lots of the television that they receive are shows from the United States. The United States is a number one exporter of video and television programs and movie industry also. So it's an interesting question that needs research, and it would be great if, you know, we had more information about that. Mm-hmm. But I think that as markets, because the cosmetic industry is, it's a product of the market. It's connected with industry. So as various industries grow and go all over the globe, we will see more and more use of makeup products everywhere.
What can you tell, what can makeup tell you about a woman if you were to guess and you could just see by appearances? Can you in any way judge a woman by her cover, so to speak, on her face?
Well, I think we do that all the time. It's something that we are trained to do and something that we are expected to see a woman to be well-groomed. And I think that's the bottom line, is that a woman that does not wear makeup or doesn't do her hair or doesn't watch over her weight gets criticized. We tend to criticize that woman as deficient, as a woman who doesn't care, and as if she's breaking the rules. And we tend as a society to reward the women who play the game of femininity and buy products and use them. We reward them with better jobs. We know very well that certain women who look a certain way will have more success in the marketplace. They will get better jobs. They will be perhaps rewarded better at the game of love. Mm-hmm. We know that attractive people are treated, have more privileges in our society. So we all judge and we all pay a lot of attention to appearances, unfortunately.
What about the popularity of makeup among men? Is that taking hold? If so, what types of makeup?
Well, there is the metrosexual man who perhaps uses, I don't know, mascara or nail polish. I think that, of course, you look at certain groups of men, for example, rockers, they will use makeup just to make a statement of how they're different. For men, the question is how well-groomed they are without necessarily wearing makeup per se. How well their hair is cut, how clean are their nails, do they have clean skin, do they have ear hairs or not? I mean, that's the issue with men more so than application of makeup.
Scott writes in an email to us, high heels were first worn by Frenchmen in the 17th century. He comments, he says, it's interesting that the female human must demonstrate physical attractiveness even beyond men when just about every other female organism tends to have a drab, sometimes camouflaged appearance. So, yes, among birds, for instance, that the males tend to be the brighter ones, don't they? So an interesting comment there from Scott. Any other observations about this? I want to leave our guests with perhaps a parting comment about this. What trends do you see in beauty, fashion, makeup, whatever your particular area of expertise, do you see happening right now that you might find interesting or disturbing to mention right now? Professor Cast, may I ask you to go first?
I think one of the interesting things right now that we're seeing is that the expectation to maintain a particular body is lasting longer and longer through the life course. We are, I think, constantly bombarded with women in Hollywood who are getting their bodies back quickly after having babies, and Demi Moore, who looks like she's the perfect 25-year-old at the age of 40-plus. And so the expectations are not just among the youth anymore, but are among older populations of women as well.
So we've got this continued fixation on youth. Professor Damhorst?
Well, we haven't really talked about tattooing and piercing, and I think that tattooing is something, and piercing is something that both men and women are involved in, and it's kind of challenging our notions of what's beautiful and how you should express the self. I think there is a lot of interest in manipulating the body and doing things with it, and I doubt that we're going to see that disappear in the 21st century.
We've done entire shows on tattooing, in matter of fact. Thank you very much for joining our discussion. Very interesting. Beauty and the things we do to look beautiful, but may not be good for us. Professor Damhorst, Professor Cast, and Professor Witsatsous of Iowa State University, we appreciate you coming into our studios.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, production assistants today from Christina Sarnelli. Also help from Michael Yeager in Ames. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.